A note. This episode includes mentions of violence and sexual themes that may not be appropriate for all listeners. This is Side Door, a podcast from the Smithsonian with support from PRX. I'm Lizzie Peabody. Okay, Justin, we are starting this episode with a game. Are you ready to play?
I like games.
A few weeks ago, before the days of social distancing, I got Side Door senior producer Justin O'Neill out of the studio for a quick game of How Are These Things Related?
Okay, I'm going to show you two things, and you have to guess how they're related.
It's a pretty self-explanatory game.
Okay, you ready to see the first thing?
Lay it on me.
All right, let's go.
We started at the Smithsonian's National Museum of American History, in front of one of the most iconic displays.
Right here, we've got Julia Child's kitchen. It's like a time machine to the 1950s. I see like a yellow tablecloth, some of the era teal cabinetry. And beyond that, like it's a standard well-to-do person's kitchen.
Yeah, except it belonged to Julia Child.
That was thing number one. For thing two, we went next door to the Smithsonian's National Museum of Natural History.
All right, we're going this way.
Museum specialist Christina Gebhardt led us through an unmarked door and down a hallway and into an elevator and down another hall to the division of birds.
Where all the magic happens.
We're in like a warehouse of cabinets, essentially.
Yeah. And cabinets filled with taxidermied birds.
Take us to the thing.
All right. Here we go.
Christina opened a cabinet and pulled out a green-billed woodpecker.
I believe the one you're looking for is in my hand. So, something about...
And she read the tag, which described the genus, species, the contents of the bird's stomach, which was ants, if you were wondering. The tag also noted that this bird was collected by the 8th Secretary of the Smithsonian.
By S. Dillon Ripley, 1944.
Okay, so, Justin, we're here in front of this little woodpecker. Mm-hmm. Any ideas how this woodpecker might be related to what we just saw? Julia Child's kitchen?
I have literally no idea what these two things might have in common. Did she make, like, a woodpecker stew?
Ew. No.
She uses wooden spoons. And these are woodpeckers?
Is it anything to do with the feathers?
No.
No.
They had a few more guesses, but they weren't even close.
Then I'm out of guesses. I don't know.
All right, what was the answer?
Yeah, Lizzie.
Okay, the answer is... Julia Child was a member of a spy network that S. Dillon Ripley was working for as a spy at the time when he shot this bird. So, spies.
Awesome! Whoa! Now that's very cool. Okay.
Before there was the CIA, there was the OSS. The Office of Strategic Services, an intelligence organization that included future Smithsonian Secretary S. Dillon Ripley and not-yet-famous chef Julia Child. During World War II, the OSS pulled together Americans from all walks of life to gather critical intelligence and even sent agents behind enemy lines to spy on the Nazis from within. This time on Side Door, we tell the story of one of those secret agents, a woman whose courage and cunning made her one of the greatest American spies of all time. Virginia Hall hid in plain sight, took names, saved lives, and fought the Nazis, all on one leg.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance, too, with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
On a crisp morning in December 1933, Virginia Hall set off bird hunting with some friends. Athletic, adventurous, and competitive, she wanted to be the first to bag a bird. which might be why she didn't engage the safety catch on her 12-gauge shotgun.
Unfortunately, she tripped on a wire fence, and as she fell, she grabbed her gun, and she literally shot herself in the foot. Ugh.
This is author Sonia Purnell. She wrote about Virginia Hall's life in her book, A Woman of No Importance, The Untold Story of the American Spy Who Helped Win World War II. In it, she describes this pivotal moment in Virginia's life.
She was absolutely gushing blood. Her friends scooped her up and rushed her into the local hospital, where the only possible way of saving her life was by cutting off her left leg. This was such a rude awakening for Virginia, and for a while she thought her life was over.
How old was she at the time?
She was 27.
Oh my gosh. By the time she was 27, Virginia had spent her whole life dreaming of adventure. And that set her apart from the time that she was young, when girls were expected to be proper.
She was a tomboy. She once went into high school with a bracelet made out of live snakes, you know. So she was quite unusual, a bit of a character, but also a leader.
Her mother had high hopes that she would marry a rich man and settle into a comfortable life as a Baltimore socialite. But Virginia had other plans.
Her great aim was to be an ambassador. No women had been ambassadors by this point.
That must have been a great disappointment to her mother.
Didn't quite fit in with Mrs. Hall's great plan, no.
But Mrs. Hall wasn't the only one to be disappointed. Because even with years of university study, international travel, and fluency in five languages, count them.
French, Italian, Spanish, Russian, and German.
That's five.
Wow.
The State Department denied her entry to the Foreign Service. First, because she didn't pass the test. Then, because papers went missing. And finally, because she was an amputee. But Sonia says...
We kind of guess what might have been going on here, because there were only six women out of 1,500 American diplomats at the time. And they clearly didn't want Virginia, yeah.
The State Department didn't make Virginia an ambassador, but they did offer her a role as a secretary. And she spent the next several years in Europe. But she was not happy. She was unhappy just because she was in administrative roles?
Yeah.
Or...
So she was given very, very menial tasks, answering the phone, filing.
So Virginia found something less boring to do. After World War II broke out in 1939, she volunteered as an ambulance driver for the French Army, ferrying the wounded from the battlefield to the hospital under machine gun fire. And I'd be shocked by this, except that this is a woman who wore a live snake bracelet. She could have been snug as a bug in a rug at home. Her own country wasn't even in the war yet.
You're absolutely right. America was not in the war yet. Her mother would much rather have gone back to Baltimore, obviously, and had a safe and comfortable life. But that just wasn't Virginia. Okay, so her country wasn't taking part. But as far as she was concerned, that didn't mean to say that she couldn't do her bit.
So... how did Virginia become a spy then?
This moment, this history-changing moment happened where she bumped into, by chance, an undercover British agent.
And it happened in the place where all the best movie moments happen, the train station.
And he realised here was a force of nature. So he gave her the phone number. He said it was of a friend. Actually, it was the phone number of a new British secret service, the one called Special Operations Executive.
The SOE, Winston Churchill's so-called Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare. By now, the Germans had taken over France, and the British were desperate to get a spy in there to see what was going on.
But it was so perilous, so unknown, that after 6 months of trying, they hadn't managed to get one person in yet. And so when Virginia Hall comes calling and says, I'll do it, and I'm American, so I can go in, I'll pretend I'm a journalist and write pieces for the New York Post, that's what they did.
In September 1941, Virginia Hall infiltrated the city of Lyon in central France. Nobody gave the 35-year-old amputee much of a chance of surviving the first few days.
Her job, with no contacts, no reception committee, virtually no training, was to kickstart the flames of the resistance. No one had really done this. The resistance didn't exist at this point.
Lyon at the time was under the rule of the Vichy government, Nazi collaborators. The Vichy police and the Gestapo, who were the German secret police, encouraged neighbors to turn on one another by offering cash rewards to people who accused others of treasonous activities, like listening to foreign news radio or associating with Jewish people. There were thousands of denunciations every day. And into this atmosphere of paranoia came Virginia. Her job was to grow an invisible resistance network of ordinary citizens who could remain undetected in French society while establishing safe houses and stockpiling weapons so that when the Allied forces eventually invaded, the resistance could spring into action from behind enemy lines.
And her first recruits were nuns. She recruited nuns in a convent, and she made the convent into a safe house. And then she recruited the local brothel madam.
The city's leading brothel madam became a powerful ally to Virginia. She instructed her girls, as she called them, to spy on their German clients.
And to drug them so that they could steal documents from their uniforms and photograph them, and even infect them deliberately and put them out of action.
Really?
Oh, yeah. All sorts of intelligence was passed to her in this way, and she also recruited their gynecologist.
Ah. The gynecologist gave them white cards, indicating that they were free of gonorrhea and syphilis so that they could go on infecting German soldiers. But before the sex workers got too sick, the doctor would treat them. Wow. Yeah, that is one group of people I've never considered when thinking about a war front.
Exactly. I mean, I think that's what was interesting about Virginia was that she recruited where she thought it was a good idea, not because it was fashionable or whatever, but these were women who were prepared to do their bit.
As a journalist, Virginia communicated with London through articles that she wired back, which contained coded messages. Meanwhile, her resistance network kept growing. Soon, she had allies in all corners of French society.
She recruited police chiefs. She recruited people in the town hall who could do fake IDs, prison officers, nurses, all kinds of things.
With this network in place, Virginia could get people out of jail, hide them, procure false papers.
She soon became a legendary figure. Her main code name was Marie. Marie of Lyon was thought to be able to do anything.
But her success gained her the one thing she did not want as a spy. Recognition. And soon, the Gestapo had their own name for her.
They called her Artemis. They had a code name for her, Artemis, the Greek goddess of hunting, because they thought hunting her down was their sport.
The Nazis put up posters all across France, urging everyone to watch for the limping lady.
Posters saying this is the most dangerous of all Allied spies. We must find and destroy her.
After 13 months behind enemy lines, Virginia's informants told her that the Gestapo was closing in. She had to get out immediately. But the only way out of the country was on foot, through the Pyrenees Mountains. And it was November 1942, one of the snowiest of the century.
The only thing that she could do was take one of the highest passes, one that no one in their right mind would go over, let alone in very, very heavy snow with the Gestapo in pursuit. And of course, on top of all of that, she had a primitive wooden leg.
Virginia's prosthesis was a hollow piece of wood, strapped on over the knee with leather straps that went all the way up to her waist. She called it Cuthbert, and she used it to smuggle important documents. But Cuthbert was not made for mountaineering. And because the wooden ankle couldn't bend, Virginia had to climb the mountain
sideways. Oh. In absolute agony, blood pouring from her stump.
And she had to hide her pain and Cuthbert from the guide she'd paid to take her through the mountains illegally. Because these guides were ruthless.
If they thought you were going to get them caught by slowing them down, they'd push you in a ravine or shoot you in the back of the head. You know, they weren't sentimental about this. And so she had to keep up.
How would she have hidden her, you know, she's bleeding from her stump?
Well, she's wearing pants and she's binding every time they stop, even for a few minutes. She tries to hide and bind the leg, try and hide the blood as much as she can. They're in a howling blizzard, so I'm sure that visibility was pretty difficult anyway. Somehow she managed to keep going.
From the shelter of a hut in the Pyrenees, Virginia radioed back to London that she was okay. But Cuthbert was, quote, being tiresome.
The duty officer that night signaled back if Cuthbert tiresome, have him eliminated, assuming Cuthbert must have been someone that she was with. So there was a little bit of a misunderstanding there, but I think everyone was put right in the end.
In the end, Virginia made the 50-mile trek over the mountains into bordering Spain, out of reach of the Gestapo. But her life as a spy was just beginning. Soon, she'd join forces with the budding American spy network that had heard her name from across the Atlantic. That's coming up after the break.
Support for Smithsonian Side Door comes from Odoo. What is Odoo? Well, Odoo is the only software your business will ever need. Featuring a suite of integrated business applications, Odoo connects your business operations together so you can get more done in less time. Odoo has apps for everything: CRM, accounting, sales, HR, inventory, marketing, manufacturing, you name it. Odoo's got it. To learn more, visit odoo.com/sidedoor. That's odoo.com/sidedoor.
We're back, and we're telling the story of Virginia Hall, an American spy who worked for the British during World War II. But before we go any further with her story, let's check back in on the home front. In 1941, when Virginia was undercover in France, the U.S. had not yet entered the war. But President Franklin D. Roosevelt had a pretty good sense that we soon would, and he was anxious about the kind of intelligence-gathering capabilities the U.S. had, or didn't have.
There was no one to put things together, to connect the dots.
This is Randy Burkett, CIA historian. He says Roosevelt appointed a friend, a former New York attorney and World War I veteran called Wild Bill Donovan, to head a new intelligence network called the Office of Strategic Services, the OSS. Their job was to collect strategic intelligence. And this was important because at that time,
the U.S. in particular was very weak at the beginning of World War II.
Weak in the sense of intelligence gathering or just weak militarily?
Weak militarily as well. I think at the time, Romania had a larger army than we did. When you're weak, you turn to guerrilla warfare and sabotage because you want to tie up forces, but it's going to be a long time before you can go in conventionally and just defeat them.
By gathering strategic intelligence, the OSS could learn how the enemy's war machine functioned and then throw strategic wrenches into that machine, gum things up, slow things down, and make the most of their limited military might. And it was Bill Donovan's job to get that intel. So he got creative. He started with the people he already knew.
Donovan turns to his clients. Businessmen who had been in these industries, who had traveled enough, knew the other side.
But he also turned to people he didn't know at all.
Refugees coming in off boats from these war zones.
Oh.
Buying everything they have. Buying their clothes, their shoes, their luggage, everything they have in their pockets.
Really?
Right. Because what we're going to do next is we're going to want to put people into those occupied areas.
Donovan's team studied these items down to the stitching in the hem of the skirts. If the OSS was going to send agents into enemy territory, they needed the right clothes to look the part. And they needed fake passports and money. So
we hire counterfeiters. Most of the money we used in Germany and occupied France and Italy was counterfeit. And so where do you find people who can forge and counterfeit? In jail. So we're hiring criminals. So we're hiring.
Wait a minute. So let me get this straight. So the foundation of the OSS was the titans of industry and a bunch of criminals.
Yes. And talented people wherever we could find them.
Like Virginia Hall in France, Bill Donovan recruited wherever it made sense. The OSS included professional athletes, actors, divers, parachuters, safecrackers, linguists. It was like the crew from Ocean's 11, talented people of every stripe. The OSS grew to include 13,000 people, including S. Dillon Ripley, who would later be the 8th Secretary of the Smithsonian. Ripley, while undercover as an ornithologist in Sri Lanka, shot that green-billed woodpecker we saw in the collections. And Julia Child spoke about her time in the OSS in this 1995 PBS interview.
I got into the OSS. But having no languages and no skills, I ended up in the files, and I stayed in the files all during the war. But at least I knew what was going on.
So you actually reported to Donovan? Did you report to Donovan?
I was in his private office for a while.
With the OSS, the United States was doing something they'd never done before.
Building a resistance group in a foreign country, and this kind of work, putting people out either alone or very small groups, sometimes three or four people at a time, was all new to us.
But it wasn't new to one American. Stories of Virginia's courage behind enemy lines in France had made it back to the U.S. and back to Bill Donovan. Here's author Sonia Purnell again.
While Bill Donovan, a tremendous character in his own right, you know, loved the stories about Virginia. He was a great romantic and daring-do kind of fellow and sort of loved the idea of this female agent he kept hearing about. So he was always a great supporter of hers.
Now, by 1944, Virginia Hall really wanted to get back into France. She did not like being on the sidelines, and she had scores to settle with the Nazis. But the Brits said, no way, Jose.
There's no way we're going to send you back. Every single German knows exactly who you are. You are brûlée, the word for compromise. There's no way.
Brûlée?
Brûlée, like burnt. Yeah.
She leaves the SOE, comes over to the OSS, convinces the OSS she can go back safely by disguising herself as a more elderly woman.
Virginia couldn't go back to France herself. By now, every German soldier knew her face. She had to go in disguise.
So she went to a London dentist who ground down her lovely white American teeth so they looked like a French peasant's teeth.
She dyed her hair gray and turned her limp into an arthritic shuffle.
She wore lots of skirts, thick skirts, to make herself look a bit stouter, and that was also a good way to hide her Colt pistol.
She was, you know, pretty much fearless.
Disguised as an elderly milkmaid, Virginia operated on farms south of Paris. She shuffled into town under the guise of selling cheese, all the while listening in on German soldiers' conversations, noting their convoy routes and numbers. Then she radioed all this information back to the Allies. In June 1944, the Allies launched their D-Day invasion of France's northern coast.
Allied naval forces, supported by strong air forces, began landing Allied armies this morning on the northern coast of France.
But to defeat the Nazis, they knew they needed the help of every able-bodied resistance fighter embedded within the country itself. The OSS sent Virginia on her most ambitious mission yet, and it meant climbing another mountain. Away in the hills of the Haute-Loire Department of France hid small groups of refugees, people who'd fled the cities for the countryside to avoid forced labor or capture by the Nazis. They were known as the Maquis.
But they were completely vulnerable. They had one gun, pretty much, between all of them.
Wow.
Oh, yeah, they had nothing.
Virginia's challenge was to turn this unarmed, motley crew into a disciplined army.
There she was arriving, a woman out of nowhere, a foreign woman with a wooden leg. Look, follow me, guys. Do what I'm telling you to do, and I will bring you those guns.
She started by coordinating parachute drops of uniforms, boots,
ammunition and explosives and money and food and vitamins. Some of these people were starving.
She schooled her new army in guerrilla warfare. Then she mobilized on orders to target the new German military headquarters in a nearby town. The Maquis worked covertly, isolating the Germans bit by bit. They cut electrical and phone lines leading into the town, ambushed German resupply convoys, blew up critical roads, bridges, and railways,
and made them believe that they were surrounded by vast armies, but were surrounded by actually quite a small ragbag army of doctors and farm laborers and vets and schoolboys.
Without phone lines, the isolated Germans had to use wireless radio signals to communicate with each other. But Virginia was listening. So she knew when the Germans planned to escape, and the Maquis were ready for them. They fought for 5 days, killing over 150 Germans and taking over 1,000 prisoners. On the final day of battle, the German major surrendered to the Maquis with 600 men.
600 of them without a single professional soldier. The whole department of the Haute-Loire in France was liberated from the Germans. That's what an achievement it was.
The Maquis had gone from ragbag resistance to liberation force. Virginia Hall was called the Madonna of the Mountains.
Virginia Hall is a legend in that part of France. They revere her. Some of the resistance who worked with her, and they wrote each other and they said things to each other like, it had been worth being born just to have met Virginia Hall and to have fought along with her.
It wasn't until after the war that the Allies could really take stock of the magnitude of Virginia's contribution. In Lyon, she'd planted key sleeper cells of the resistance that would help to hasten the end of the war. And the intelligence she gathered as a milkmaid...
That intelligence had been pivotal in the Allies liberating Paris.
When World War II ended, Virginia Hall was the only civilian woman to be awarded the Distinguished Service Cross. President Truman invited her to the White House for a public ceremony, but she refused.
She wanted to go on being a secret agent, which is why when she received the Distinguished Service Cross, she wanted it done in secret, because she wanted to go and join what would become the CIA, which eventually she did.
Virginia finished her career at the CIA. She died in 1982 at the age of 76. And today, the CIA honors her concretely.
We have a facility named for her. I can't talk much more about that.
Because it's secret?
Yeah. I mean, but it's just one way we can honor her.
Yeah. So you can't tell us where it is?
No.
Or what it does? Or the shape of it? The architectural style? I'm kidding. In 2019, the Smithsonian Museum of American History acquired a gold coin, which honors the men and women of the OSS. On the front, anonymous silhouettes evoke the many Americans who risked their safety for their country. The back of the coin is full of mission code words, and one of them is Cuthbert. One more name to remind us of Virginia Hall, a woman with many names and even more feats of courage. You've been listening to Side Door, a podcast from the Smithsonian with support from PRX. For a photograph of Virginia Hall receiving her Distinguished Service Cross in Bill Donovan's office, where Julia Child evidently spent a lot of time filing, subscribe to our newsletter at si.edu/sidedoor. And definitely follow us on Twitter and Instagram at SideDoorPod. For more stories of important women in history, be sure to look into the Smithsonian American Women's History Initiative. To learn more, go to womenshistory.si.edu or join the conversation using hashtag becauseofherstory on social media. If you're stuck at home with cabin fever or stuck in a closet like me recording this podcast, and you find yourself pushing the random article button on Wikipedia and you think this would make an amazing Side Door episode, email us at sidedoor@si.edu. And if you love the show, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. It's the little things like that that really keep us going these days. Special thanks to Lauren Lyons, Ruth Robbins, and Amanda Skiandra at the Smithsonian Associates. Our podcast team is Justin O'Neill, Natalie Boyd, Ann Cananan, Caitlin Schaefer, Jess Sadek, Lara Koch, and Sharon Bryant. Episode artwork is by Greg Fisk. Extra support comes from John, Jason, and Genevieve at PRX. Our show is mixed by Tarek Fuda. Our theme song and other episode music are by Breakmaster Cylinder. If you want to support our show, email sponsorship@prx.org. I'm your host, Lizzie Peabody. Thanks for listening. So, is there anyone Virginia was afraid of?
Her mother. Yeah.
No.
Her mom.